I'm sure a lot of you guys remember the old ceremonial hunting tradition of eating the heart out of the first animal you kill. Meat from those organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. You can get those same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And remember, use code MeatEater for 10% off your purchase.
Outdoor adventure won't wait for engine problems. Things like hard starts, rough performance, and lost fuel economy are often caused by fuel gum and varnish buildup. Seafoam can help your engine run better and last longer. You simply pour a can into your gas tank. Hunters and anglers rely on Seafoam to keep their engines running the way it should the entire season. So pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit seafoamworks.com to learn more.
Hey guys, turkey season is in full swing right now, and if you are planning on getting after it, make sure to pick up some Meat Eater Phelps turkey calls to stuff into the old turkey vest or into your fanny pack right now. I carry a few different things. I like to use mouth calls, and I like to use pot calls. Mouth calls or diaphragms, I like them because it gives you hand-free calling, meaning when you're working a bird up close, you can have your gun on your knee, finger on the trigger, ready to roll, and still be making turkey sounds. I like pot calls because I just like pot calls. I enjoy calling with a pot call. Whatever direction you go, including a box call, which I don't personally use too much, but they're fun and great, and I started out with them. Yanni, on the other hand, one of my main turkey hunting buddies, he loves box calls. And what's funny is I'll now and then look to him and give him the look that means get out your box call and find us a turkey. So it's not that I don't like him. I just have Yanni use his. Then I don't have to carry it. Go to Phelps Game Calls. Get calls that are made in the USA and get calls that'll get them close. Find yours at PhelpsGameCalls.com today.
Welcome to the Wired to Hunt Foundations podcast, your guide to the fundamentals of better deer hunting. Presented by First Light, creating proven, versatile hunting apparel for the stand, saddle, or blind. First Light. Go farther, stay longer. And now, your host, Tony Peterson.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Wired to Hunt Foundations podcast, which is brought to you by First Light. I'm your host, Tony Peterson, and this episode is all about running cameras, but not running them like other folks. Probably one of the biggest reasons that I love hunting is because there's never a good excuse to stop learning. And there isn't anything you can do where you'll just know it all. Sure, if you're into a small town bar in, say, Southwest Wisconsin about, I don't know, mid-October, you'll inevitably meet someone who is 14 beers deep, you know, wearing a faded Realtree shirt from 1997, who will let you know that he has the whole thing totally dialed. But the truth is, he doesn't. And neither do you. I was reminded of this recently when I drove over to northern Wisconsin to cut down some trees, scout some deer, and pull a few cameras I had left up from November. The images that I found when I checked those cameras, they have literally changed the course of my hunting plans for this year. They taught me a few things that you might be able to learn from as well. As I get older, I realize there's just like a lot of things that I actively dislike. You know, forced small talk, that's way up there on the list. Social media, you know, that's maybe right there at the top of the list. Standing in line for any reason tends to get under my skin. Mark Kenyon, well, you know, kind of just in general is pretty tough to deal with. But there is one thing about modern society that I absolutely love: music. Or more specifically, you can listen to any damn song you want at any time and can be exposed to new music all day long. You can search it out. You know, you could watch some new TV series that is chock full of interesting music. It's all over. It has also led to an interesting conundrum for musicians, in that anyone who has ever written a song might find music that is similar to theirs out there somewhere. Every once in a while, you see a news story on this situation, where some popular artist will have to go to court to defend a chord progression or a specific melody after a different artist, usually a pretty much unknown artist, says that they wrote it first and that they got ripped off and are definitely entitled to some enormous royalties. This is interesting because some musicians openly talk about how they lift certain riffs from their favorite guitarists or heavily lean on some type of music for inspiration. If there is a spirit of admiration in this and a tip of the hat to the inspiration, it's often an issue of respect and doesn't go to court. This tends to happen when two successful artists or bands collide, but isn't the case when a successful artist creates something similar to a no-namer? Now, there are legitimate cases of this, I'm sure, but these no-namers also give off strong ambulance chaser vibes, and it feels like they're looking for a payday and not much else. You know, then you have the classic plagiarizer accusations. I didn't know this until very recently, but apparently, a lot of people thought Nirvana's anthem for disenfranchised teenagers in the early 90s, Smells Like Teen Spirit, apparently sounds a hell of a lot like Boston's More Than a Feeling. I guess, maybe. Then you have the big one, Led Zeppelin's monster huge mega hit, Stairway to Heaven, which for all you young fellas out there struggling with the ladies, just learn to play the intro to that song on an acoustic guitar, and at least you'll have a fighting chance. Since it's been a few decades since Led Zeppelin topped the charts, look at it this way. They were like a group of Taylor Swifts, swifting it up all over the planet for quite a few years, and Stairway to Heaven was their biggest hit amongst a hell of a lot of big hits. In 2016, after Stairway to Heaven had been out for multiple decades, the bassist from a band called Spirit filed a lawsuit saying that Led Zeppelin had ripped off some of his riffs, I guess. A jury found that to be grade A bullshit, but it was a good try anyway. The thing about this stuff is that you can't escape inspiration if you're creating things. It's impossible to be a music lover and an artist and not draw from others' work. That's actually what's pretty cool about music and authors and painters and anyone who takes an idea and turns it into something that others can enjoy in some form. In that way, it's like a giant collaboration between different people. And do you know what else is like that? Golf. I'm sorry. I actually am sorry. I feel really bad. I can't help myself. It's hunting. And more specifically, hunting strategies and styles. We see what others are doing and we emulate them with kind of a personal twist. It's no different from hearing a song that worms its way into your brain and then finding yourself playing some chord progression that sounds an awful lot like that song because for whatever reasons, those sounds in that order make you happy. With hunting, you might see someone who puts a series of food plots on a small property to not only draw deer in, but funnel them through on a specific route. Or you might have a buddy who is a certified public land whitetail nutcase who runs cameras in a way that is just better and different from your personal strategy. This is what happened to me with my buddy Clint Campbell, who coincidentally, or maybe not, is also one hell of a guitar player. But you probably know him as the host of the Truth from the Stand podcast. But he's also a hunter who plays the long game with trail cameras. He's always sending me pictures of big mountain bucks from Pennsylvania, along with texts that explain how he's piecing together a large puzzle on ground that anyone can hunt, even though most of his competition isn't hunting the way he is and certainly isn't scouting the way he is. Now, Clint's scouting style, you know, it's just vastly different from a lot of public land whitetail hunters. He covers a lot of ground, which is similar, you know, especially in the winter and the, you know, early spring months. He obsesses over access, deer sign, you know, all the usual suspects, but he also puts cameras out and leaves them for months at a time to gather a better picture of what the local bucks do through, you know, different months, different weather events, different times of the year when they might deal with tons of people or almost no people. This is not something I've done a whole lot in my life, but I've started to lift a few riffs from Clint, if you will. It happened mostly by an accident of timing, at least the first time I left my cameras out. That was in northern Wisconsin, and I thought I'd have to, you know, have some time to run out and grab a camera before winter set in. I didn't, and so one of my cameras stayed out there shivering in the cold, but diligently taking pictures for me, so that when I pulled it in the spring, I got to see all kinds of interesting stuff. I got to see who made it through the gun season and who survived until various points of the winter. I got to see how a huge blizzard affected deer movement and what a three-week thaw did to their travels and habits. It was interesting, but mostly showed me that there were a couple of spots I probably should have had stands to sit during the rut. Since then, I've conducted a more deliberate trail camera strategy over there to see what the long game look into the deer's world would reveal. This year, I took it to a higher level, I guess, kinda, by leaving three cameras apiece on two different pieces of private ground over there. I hung all of them in mid-October while the rut was still going and the gun season was coming up quick. Now, when I went back to pull those cameras in the beginning of March, the card showed a story that was fascinating from start to finish. Well, if I'm being honest, five of the cameras did, because one of them never took a picture because I left it on setup mode and never actually started it, which is the deer hunting equivalent of filling a knee-high sock with gravel and then swinging it as hard as you can right at your own knackers.
Now, a lot of you guys are familiar with the old hunting tradition of eating, you know, some organ, the heart or a chunk of liver off the first animal you kill. I had that when I was a little kid, and it was a big deal. Organ meats were always prized by frontier people who knew the importance of getting a lot of different minerals and nutrients. And as often is the case, those guys were onto something, because organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. And you can get the same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil, made exclusively from regeneratively raised, grass-fed, and finished cattle. Heart and Soil's unique freeze-drying process means all those important nutrients are trapped in, ensuring you experience every one of the benefits of nature's superfood in a clean, convenient, taste-free capsule. Find out more at heartandsoil.co and make sure to use code MEATEATER for 10% off your purchase. That's heartandsoil.co. Use the code MEATEATER. Hey guys, turkey season is in full swing right now, and if you are planning on getting after it, make sure to pick up some MEATEATER Phelps turkey calls to stuff into the old turkey vest or into your fanny pack right now. I carry a few different things. I like to use mouth calls, and I like to use pot calls. Mouth calls or diaphragms, I like them because it gives you hand-free calling, meaning when you're working a bird up close, you can have your gun on your knee, finger on the trigger, ready to roll, and still be making turkey sounds. I like pot calls because I just like pot calls. I enjoy calling with a pot call. Whatever direction you go, including a box call, which I don't personally use too much, but they're fun and great, and I started out with them. Yanni, on the other hand, one of my main turkey hunting buddies, he loves box calls. And what's funny is I'll now and then look to him and give him the look that means get out your box call and find us a turkey. So it's not that I don't like him, I just have Yanni use his. Then I don't have to carry it. Go to Phelps Game Calls. Get calls that are made in the USA and get calls that'll get them close. Find yours at PhelpsGameCalls.com today.
The other five did much better. For starters, I wanted to see what the buck movement looked like during the Wisconsin gun season, since it's the time when about 600,000 people hit the woods with rifles in their hands. Now, while the deer movement definitely slowed down then, it didn't stop. Not even the daylight movement. At its most basic level, it showed that a lot of time in stand on either property would have probably led to an encounter with a few different bucks. Listen, not great, but not terrible. It also showed a group of does on one of my properties walking down a trail half an hour into the morning on the second day of the season. Then they spooked, and my buddy walked down the trail 4 minutes later on his way to sit one of my stands. He saw six does, which is a lot for that area, and then walked out an hour and a half later. He had no idea he booted all of those does ahead of him on the way in, and he wasn't there long enough to witness any of the midday movement that happened there later. I've unintentionally run this experiment with him and his dad several times, and it's always a lesson in time on stand. they have very little faith in a buck walking by, so they don't put in hardly any time on stand in the midday or even when it's prime time sometimes. Judging by the picks I've gotten during the gun season, their strategy is costing them deer. Another interesting finding from just running multiple cameras during a busy gun season was that while there were days when the overall movement was really rough, the best buck movement was almost always between like 9 a.m. and 2 p.m. That midday thing is real. It's just hard to believe for a lot of folks, especially in a high hunting pressure situation. But if you think about it, if your state's gun season happens during the rut, which is real common, those bucks aren't going to stop chasing and cruising. You know, they might do a lot of their looking when there is a lull in the hunter activity, which happens in the middle of the day. I know you know that, but do you know it with experience or because you've heard dipshits like me say it? Because there's a big difference there. I was also really curious to see who was left after the gun season. I don't mean this just in terms of bucks either. The county we hunt over there offers up a huge amount of doe tags, which makes zero sense to me considering it took me 21 days of hunting to see a single doe last fall. Maybe the deer managers over there know something I don't, or maybe I know something they don't. Anyway, I just wanted to see how many deer made it through. I'd have guessed I might have had a couple of bucks on each property and a couple of does, but it was clear that at least 6 bucks made it through in each place and that a decent amount of does did as well. You know, pretty similar to the number of bucks. What was cool was that there was a mix of bucks at each place ranging from barely spikes to one deer that is probably pushing 160 inches and who, by the couple of times I got pictures of him, showed me he does not like trail cameras one bit. There's a lesson in there too. In fact, his reaction was not unlike just about every old long-nosed doe that spotted my cameras over there. This year, all of my cameras will be a lot more discreet. What was really interesting in the post-gun season findings, besides taking stock in the survivors, was seeing the conditions that got the deer moving. We've had the mildest winter pretty much ever, I think. But the few cold fronts we had, you know, kind of during December, got the deer on their feet. No surprise there. It was just interesting to see on two different properties and also see, once again, how often they moved right in the middle of the day when it was very unlikely to be motivated by anything other than food. Definitely probably not the rut. What really started to stand out to me as I filed through thousands of pictures was that the buck activity didn't really change much from at least one perspective. There was far more consistent movement over there, even if that movement wasn't all that frequent. What I mean by that is, you know, for example, on one of the cameras that allows me to monitor a subtle trail that keeps the deer in the woods and away from the houses or openings or anything anywhere nearby where they might get spotted, there is always a buck in daylight at some point in every 2 or 3 day time period. Now, this isn't southern Iowa, so that's actually pretty good considering a whole section over there might not even have a dozen bucks using it on any given year. Where that camera was, there is now a sneaky access trail cut to a double trunk pine tree that will have a stand in it for next fall, and I will go in there and I will hunt it hard during the rut if I still have a tag left. I'm honestly more excited for that than anything this fall, besides, you know, getting another crack at putting one of my daughters on a bear. And keep in mind, I'm probably going to draw an Iowa tag this year. Another zoom out epiphany that I had, which my buddy still doesn't believe, is that the northern Wisconsin deer don't behave much different from deer in, you know, much better regions. There just aren't very many of them, and they deal with a lot more predation. This is another thing that my camera showed me, even though I knew it. I can't prove this, but other than bears, it seems like the coyotes, bobcats, and wolves all showed up and stuck around before moving on. Now, this isn't to say there weren't plenty of random picks of predators, because I had plenty. But there were also times where it was obvious the same three coyotes were working the area around my camera heavily, and that the deer movement went way down because of this. I saw that saturation of coyotes and on both places, wolves at different times. And as you can guess, when that happens, it's best to go somewhere else. Even the bobcats seem to kind of group up and hang around for a while. But I'm, you know, a little bit more inclined to believe that's just a family unit that I'm seeing there. I also have no idea what I'm talking about when it comes to this, so I'm just spitballing. Maybe the biggest takeaway from this experiment, besides how important time in the woods really is, no matter where you hunt, is that we often think about deer movement the wrong way, or in an incomplete way, I should probably say. We think of summer bucks when we first start putting cameras out, you know, and seeing our bachelor groups. And as the summer moves toward fall, we start to think about, you know, well, fall movement. This is where we laser focus and we think about feeding areas, staging areas, and funnels, you know, something that might work this week, but not the next, or might be on fire next week, but the deer just aren't quite there yet. A long game camera strategy kind of exposes that as faulty thinking. Of course, a funnel might get busier in November when the chase is on, but that same funnel will probably host some buck travel in December too, and January and February and March, and every dang month of the year, including September and October. What this means is that while you're waiting for everything to get right for a certain spot, the deer might be out there using it at their own leisure already. All of the cameras I hung in November were in spots that I thought would catch November movement. But November movement isn't as different from the movement in other months as we think, and that's important to acknowledge. And if you can, try to understand, because it has ramifications beyond where you'll do an all-day sit during your rutcation. Just think about it this way. Take your favorite pinch point, or maybe your favorite river crossing. Run a camera on it for a full year. What do you think you'd learn? My guess is that you'd learn that they are good spots beyond their usefulness in the timing window we focus on to actually hunt them. That's important, if for no other reason than to rewire your willingness to hunt whenever you can versus hunting when you believe it only should be good. A long game camera strategy can teach you this, and it's a lesson that is worth learning for everyone. It might not matter if you have a banging spot to hunt that no one else can set foot on, but when you're dealing with smaller spots or shared spots, understanding how consistent the deer movement is all year can put you in a spot to take advantage of that movement well outside the rut or well outside of whatever weekends you feel like you might just want to hunt. It's honestly a confidence thing, and that matters. It's intriguing enough to me that I'm already getting ready to put some cameras out and leave them at least until midsummer. I feel like the value of their intel won't be that high, but I also feel like I might be totally wrong on that. Plus, it's kind of like getting paid dividends on some stock or earning royalties from a book you wrote 7 years ago. In other words, you know, you're making money while you sleep, sort of. A long game camera strategy is like that, and it's worth it if you have the opportunity. It's also worth it to listen next week, because I'm going to take a deep dive into the topic of game management. That's it for this episode. I'm Tony Peterson, and this has been the Wired to Hunt Foundations podcast, which is brought to you by First Light. As always, thank you so much for all your support. We honestly appreciate it so much here at Meat Eater. All of us do. If you like this podcast, if you want to listen to Clay's podcast or something else, you want to check out some how-to videos, some hunting episodes, read some articles, whatever, you can head on over to themeateater.com. Tons of hunting content there. Maybe you want a new recipe, whatever. Go there, check it out. Once again, thank you so much for your support.
I'm sure a lot of you guys remember the old ceremonial hunting tradition of eating the heart out of the first animal you kill. Meat from those organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. You can get those same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And remember, use code MeatEater for 10% off your purchase.
Outdoor adventure won't wait for engine problems. Things like hard starts, rough performance, and lost fuel economy are often caused by fuel gum and varnish buildup. Seafoam can help your engine run better and last longer. You simply pour a can into your gas tank, hunters and anglers rely on Seafoam to keep their engines running the way it should the entire season. So pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit SeafoamWorks.com to learn more.